Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Professor E.O. Wilson, that's Edward Wilson, the Pellegrino Professor of History, of Science at Harvard University. He's one of the best-known evolutionary scientists in America. He's a sociobiologist and a controversial theorist in that field. He is also an atheist, and he is our guest today on the Albert Mohler Program. Why? Because just a few weeks ago, he published a book entitled The Creation, An Appeal to Save Life on Earth. It's written in a literary form addressed to an imaginary Southern Baptist pastor. What E.O. Wilson wants to do here is to create a common ground between evolutionary environmentalists and conservative Christians in order to save the earth. It's going to be a fascinating conversation. This is just one of those places you don't expect always to find a conversation with an E.O. Wilson. He's joining us today. He says he wants a conversation with evangelicals. This is the place to find one. Get ready to call and join the conversation. The number is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. We're going to be talking with Professor E.O. Wilson, Pellegrino Professor of Science at Harvard University, about his call for a co-belligerency, common ground, between evolutionists and evangelicals to save the environment. First, a review of some issues in the news. Last night, my family and I went to see the movie The Nativity Story. And I'll tell you that I found it to be a very, very positive movie. And just to give my quick review, it straightforwardly deals with the Christmas story. It faithfully presents the main thrust of that story, and I would add that's no small achievement. I've written a review of the movie at my website at albertmohler.com. I don't deal with every aspect of the movie, but the film, The Nativity Story, which is directed by Catherine Hardwicke, it has to take some liberties with the biblical story because, after all, if you put Matthew and Luke together, you don't have a seamless narrative here. We have all that we need. The Bible's perfect and sufficient for all that we need in order to know who Christ is and to trust him. But at the same time, as we're telling the story, we realize there's some things that are implied there in the text concerning the relationship between Mary and Joseph, concerning the goings-on, the relationships, the dialogue between central characters in this drama. And the movie takes what I would consider to be very restrained liberties with this. For instance, you have invented scenes with Mary and Joseph on the pilgrimage to Bethlehem. You have representations of the brutal oppression of the Jews by King Herod the Great. You've got the relationship between Joseph and Mary being expanded to the extent that Joseph is, as developed a character in the movie as is Mary. That's very unusual, I think, in tellings of the Christmas story. It's also a pretty powerful demonstration here, I think, of the artistry of telling the story through film. Joseph the carpenter appears as a very real human being, Mary making very real human decisions, but more than that, trusting God. As he hears from the angel the word of the conception of this child in Mary by the Holy Spirit. It's a great story. Of course, you know the story, the biblical storyline. And there's no suspense when you're watching the movie. There's interest and the movie very successfully with a very fine screenplay by Mike Rich really helps to show how the story develops. Now, here is the bottom line for me. When you think about how Hollywood is going to deal with a story like this, your big question is, are they going to get the theology right? Well, Mike Rich is himself a believer, and he knows the story. And furthermore, it's clear he knows what's important in the story. The camera doesn't blink. The movie doesn't blink in dealing with the virgin birth of Jesus Christ. Not at all. As a matter of fact, it is as straightforwardly and even beautifully presented as I think I've ever seen in any context such as this. The movie does not flinch in dealing with the deity of Christ. The movie does not flinch in dealing with the fact that this is the one whom God sent, his only beloved son, to save his people from their sins. That is a very powerful reality when you consider Hollywood in the year 2006. New Line Cinema is the company that has released this. It is the first major Bible-themed movie to be released in virtually a generation. Ben-Hur and the Ten Commandments were the last two films of this stature released by a major Hollywood studio. dealing with a Bible story or a Bible theme. You may say, well, what about The Passion of the Christ? Well, that was not released by a major studio. Mel Gibson did that. It was released independently. That's very different than what's going on with the Nativity story. And furthermore, I was asked by a reporter immediately after the movie last night, do I expect controversy? And my response is no. I don't expect a lot of controversy out of this movie because the depictions, I think, are very straightforward. I don't see controversy here as in the Passion of the Christ with claims of anti-Semitism and all the rest. The character of King Herod is presented, well, about as evil as you could imagine presenting King Herod. But the reality of King Herod the Great is, if anything, worse than how he's depicted in the movie. It's almost impossible to portray that kind of evil on the film, on the screen. However, we need to remember that Herod was himself only half Jewish, and that he oppressed the Jewish people in an awful and historic way that helps us to understand why the Jewish people in the first century were so urgently looking for a Messiah who would liberate them. Of course, the Messiah who came liberated them in a completely different sense than they were expecting. But it is nonetheless a reminder of the sense of urgency that the Jews of the first century were feeling in looking for the Messiah whom God had promised. There are some funny scenes in the movie. You don't expect that necessarily. The Magi, presented here as three kings, and by the way, that's a tradition in terms of the number and the names. It just goes back to the 7th century, a European Christmas tradition. They pick up on that, and so you have the three wise men, as they are remembered in that tradition, Gaspar, Melchior, and Balthazar, and they provide some of the comic relief in the movie, and you need a little of that. It isn't hilarity. It's just something that will bring a smile as the characters of these three are displayed, but you also have a believability here. It's not farce. The other thing I want to point out is that the Magi, as presented in the movie, present some of the most important Christological material. That is, they are the ones who very clearly articulate right there at the Nativity, right there in Bethlehem, who this child is, pointing to the sign in the sky of the star. Now, as you know your biblical history, you know that, number one, we're not told how many wise men there were. That we're only told that they brought three gifts. We're certainly not told their names, and so the development of these personalities is a liberty. But quite frankly, it's the same kind of liberty you have in most nativity plays that you'll find in your local church, where, by the way, most people don't even face the problem of how to explain that the wise men weren't actually there that night. Now, in the movie, they are. So here's the question. How in the movie are you going to get the wise men to Bethlehem on the night of Christ's birth? Well, you do that because Mike Rich, in writing the screenplay, suggests that the wise men saw this astronomical reality, this apparent star coming together. And so they left the east and traveled to Bethlehem in anticipation of the great event. Now, did it happen that way? No. As a matter of fact, we would expect that the wise men, the Magi, probably arrived in Bethlehem somewhere between 6 months and 2 years after Christ's birth. Nonetheless, the story is really well presented. And so I'll be very honest. I have some questions about even making a film like this. I'm not one who believes that that the story of Christ is best formatted for the big screen. But if a movie is going to be made like this, and it's going to be made and presented to the general public, the big question is any authentic presentation of who Jesus is and why he came going to make it to the big screen? It does. This stuff was not cut out and left on the cutting room floor. That's something for which we ought to be thankful. As a matter of fact, some of the criticisms I'm seeing of the film are by people who are more into cinematography and all the techniques of film, and they criticize the way the angels are presented and the voice of God that comes to Zacharias in the temple. But you know what? I think if the director chose accuracy over artistic finesse there, we ought to be thankful for that. And I am. I commend the film. I suggest that you see it. I think it's a good opportunity for Christian parents to watch the movie with not only friends and neighbors, but also with their children. I think it's a good conversation piece for families to gather around. And then open the Gospels of Matthew and Luke and read the material together. And just think about what we think we know from the Christmas story. I mean, you ask the average person sitting in a pew of an evangelical church, how many wise men were there? And they're going to say, there were three. Well, we'll find that in the text. It's not there. What about the donkey that Mary rode on the way to Bethlehem? It's not in the text. There's no donkey. What about the innkeeper, the most maligned non-person in the New Testament? There is no innkeeper in the New Testament. All we are told is that there was no room for them in the inn. It's good sometimes not only to remember what is in the New Testament, but what is not. And when it comes to Christmas, all kinds of traditions have emerged around us that we take for granted, portray in our nativity scenes and all the rest, and we need to be reminded that what we have as the authoritative record of the Christmas story is not a film, it's just not some book, it's not a play. It is the Gospels of Matthew and Luke. They tell us all we really need to know. We are human beings whose minds want to connect the dots, and we wonder how you get from here to there. We're interested in the humanity of the story, and that's what I think this film tries successfully to portray. It is an artistic representation. Remember that. See it. Talk about it. Take your friends and neighbors to it and have a conversation about the real Jesus. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Professor Edward Wilson, who is the Pellegrino Research Professor in Entomology at Harvard University, is one of America's most respected scientists in terms of that community. He is an evolutionist. He is also a controversialist. His theory of sociobiology is widely debated in the scientific community. He has written a book, actually several, but his latest book is entitled The Creation, An Appeal to Save Life on Earth. And in this book, which is out right now in your bookstores, getting a lot of attention in the media, Professor Wilson, who does not believe in God, is suggesting that he and fellow evolutionists should join hands with evangelical Christians to save the earth, to save biodiversity, and to join hands for the stewardship of what he calls creation with a capital C. We're honored to have Professor Wilson on the Albert Mohler program today. Professor Wilson, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I said in my review of your book that evangelical Christians owe you the respect of the conversation that you request, and I hope you're getting some of that conversation.
I'm getting a lot of it. Let me correct you in one thing slightly. I do not believe in God. I believe in the possibility. It's just that I find that question still open, and I'm not dogmatic in saying that. I'm not a dogmatic atheist. Just a correction.
Well, that's a helpful clarification.
Yes, to answer your question, the responses that I've gotten from my increasing number of evangelical friends and members of other denominations has been almost unsparingly courteous and positive, and I'm very much encouraged.
Well, let me ask you just to tell us right up front why you think that evolutionists and evangelical Christians who reject evolution should be natural allies in environmentalism to save biodiversity.
Wrong question. The answer is, why should scientists, the scientific community, particularly the secularist scientific community, which are often seen at odds with the religious community, especially evangelical community, on many issues that include evolution, you know, and many others, why should they come together on this particular issue? And the reason is that we need a transcendental issue that unites us to meet on common ground and to conduct a dialogue there that could lead to something very important accomplished for both of us, for the religious faithful and for the mostly secular scientist. Each, for his own reason, holds the creation, biological diversity of the earth, in reverence. And so this would be, I think, a logical place to start a dialogue instead of continuing to lob grenades.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. And like I said in my review, I find your proposal very intriguing. I find the political aspect of your proposal very interesting as well, where you suggest that if I read you correctly, there's no way that the scientific community is going to be able to push this kind of agenda without some widespread demographic support, such as that could come from conservative Christians. Isn't that right?
Well, this is overwhelmingly a Christian nation. Even the scientists who consider themselves secularists come from mostly a Judeo-Christian tradition. And the numbers are such that I don't see how this could be just a secularist issue and ever achieve anything. But fortunately, the the Judeo-Christian community is set to do this, and long before my book appeared, we're beginning to approach these issues and do something about them seriously anyway. So this is really an offer of a hand of friendship. I'd be so presumptuous as to speak for science, a hand of friendship offered, and I know a lot of my colleagues agree completely with this, to the religious community, and they for help. I believe E here, as far as what this could achieve in political momentum, is made clear by noting that in the membership of the three leading humanist, that would be mainly secularist, societies in the United States, there are about 5,000 members. And in the National Association of Evangelicals alone, with, I've forgotten, 45,000 churches, there are 30 million members. So for the secularist, the environmentalist secularist, and I hope you know, we can also speak about religious environmentalists, the secularist to simply ignore what the reality of America today is definitely head in the sands.
I see.
Behavior.
Let me ask another question here, and I mean this very sincerely. Speaking as an evangelical Christian, I believe that we will give an answer to the Creator for our stewardship of this gift of the planet and all within it. I believe we're going to give an answer just as if we were the tenants on a farm. We're going to give an answer for how we tilled the soil and how we respected this gift. In your book, you actually capitalize the word creation. Now, I mean this in all sincerity. I just want my listeners to hear you say, why would someone who is a provisional deist, I think that's how you described yourself, why would you see anything special about creation? That would be very interesting to hear.
I wanted to make clear that it is very special. It's our greatest heritage. It's the rest of life besides our own species on this planet. It creates the environment that we all depend on moment to moment, and with just even small deviations in it, our own lives would be threatened. And furthermore, it is an absolute wonder to behold. The more the scientists dig into it and begin to analyze and understand it, the more awestruck they become. So it deserves the word the creation. And, of course, I use the word creation because I'm proposing joining forces of the religious faithful and the scientists, and I do not hesitate to put a capital C on it. Besides, I was raised Southern Baptist.
Well, as a Southern Baptist to a former Southern Baptist, I understand the doctrine of creation, but you'll understand why Christians would not capitalize the word. We would capitalize creator, but not creation, in order to hold that distinction. Does the Christian concept of stewardship I'm talking about here, does that seem to you to be an adequate ground for an environmentalism?
Yes.
Well, I think that's what a lot of Christians are really seeking to understand is how that stewardship of creation would be exercised. Your big issue here, if I understand it correctly, is biodiversity. Now, why is it that we should give that such a priority in our stewardship?
Because that is the living part of the creation. That's what I look on as the center of the creation, you know, seen from the biologist's perspective. And it's so extraordinarily important for our own survival and for the future of this planet that whether you give ascribe a divine origin to it or not is not terribly material. However it originated, the important thing is it is there, and it's all we got, and we ought to protect it.
Well, you've given us a lot to think about. Our guest today is Professor E.O., that's Edward Wilson, Pellegrino Professor at Harvard University. His new book, The Creation, An Appeal to Save Life on Earth, is in bookstores. It is prompting a lot of conversation in the media and conversation on this program. To join us, call 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Professor Wilson has addressed himself to an imaginary Southern Baptist pastor, but actually to all evangelicals in his book. He wants to start a conversation, and it's our responsibility to take that up. Professor Wilson, thank you for joining us today.
Well, I thank you.
We'll be right back with your calls. The phone number 877-893-8255, coast to coast. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. You know, it's something to be writing a book like this at age 77. Professor E.O. Wilson's been at this a very long time. If you had told me several weeks ago we'd be having him on this program, I would have wondered why. Because here's a man, and he corrected me, calling himself in his writings a provisional deist. He says it's not that he actively disbelieves in God. He just doesn't believe in God in such a way, doesn't function in any way as believing in God. In his writings, he's really gone after Christianity. He's gone after theism. He is a former Southern Baptist. That is, he was born into a Southern Baptist family. He said in one of his books, quote, "I drifted away from the church, not definitely an agnostic or atheist, just Baptist no more." He declares himself a pragmatist and a scientific humanist. He defines scientific humanism as, quote, "the only worldview compatible with science's growing knowledge of the real world and the laws of nature." In an article he published in the Harvard Magazine just about 2 years ago, he went at this again, speaking of evolution and suggesting that it is the only worldview in which the world makes sense. And how does that world make sense to him? Well, it leads him to a great concern for environmentalism and biodiversity. And it leads him also to the question that I ask him in the interview, and that is, it leads him to capitalize the word the creation. In other words, he sentimentalizes creation itself as the great good. I ask him why, and he said, because it's necessary for life. Of course, as a Christian, I've got all kinds of follow-up questions to that. Well, why is life all that important? He said it's important for the survival of humanity. Well, why is humanity all that important? You see, without a Christian worldview, I'm not certain that you can get anywhere. In fact, I'm certain that you can't get anywhere where you can make absolute claims about the significance of anything. Other than wonder, it's kind of like Carl Sagan. Professor Wilson's very much like Carl Sagan in just saying we look back at the universe with wonder. To join the conversation, call 877-893-8255. The question is, how do we answer Professor E.O. Wilson? The number 877-893-TALK from South Bend, Indiana. Jason's calling, listening on XM170. Go ahead, Jason.
Hey, Dr. Mohler. From what I gathered, you know, I may not necessarily agree with all of his worldview and stuff, but at least there's one thing I can say about Professor Wilson is that at least he displayed a measure of competence. He was courteous. He was professional. And he wasn't rancorous, which I think says a lot when you compare him with somebody like Professor Richard Dawkins. You know, because it's obvious that he doesn't share the same worldview that you and I would, but at least he's kind of given it some thought.
Yeah.
Whereas Dawkins would just totally dismiss our argument.
Yeah, and, you know, I think you're right, Jason. And by the way, I think his basically gentlemanly demeanor came across in the conversation we had just moments ago. He agreed to come on the program. There's a little story behind that, by the way. We had really not connected for a very long time. I wrote a review of his book and said, we'd love to pick up this conversation. We tried to get him on the program, but didn't get a whole lot of response. And a reporter from the Associated Press called me and asked me why we hadn't picked up on the conversation. And I said, it's because we haven't heard from Professor E.O. Wilson. He's not talking to evangelicals about his book about evangelicals or outreach to evangelicals. Well, it wasn't hardly hours after that we got a contact from Professor Wilson, very gracious. Said they, and just on the phone with me a moment ago, he said he'd been very busy, you know, talking about the book and traveling and all the rest. And so we'll give him full faith and credit for that. We're glad that he came on the program, and I owe him the respect of a guest on this program. And we're going to have a very honest conversation. I think that was started in this conversation here. I think that's why we need to talk about it. Jason, you're right. It says something that he wants to reach out to us. I also appreciate the integrity of how he approaches us. In his book, he is right up front about the fact that he wants to talk with us because he needs us. He talks about the numbers. He said, look, you add up all the humanist societies, you have about 5,000 people. You just take the National Association of Evangelicals alone, there are something like 30 million people represented. And he said, you know, we can't do this politically without a wide political base, such as those who are evangelical Christians. And he at least has some knowledge of where we come from. Now, common ground, I think that's going to be an interesting issue, because if biodiversity is the great principle of his environmentalism, that raises a host of questions. And especially, I would argue, it raises a host of questions for evolutionists, because isn't the theory of evolution about certain species dying out because they don't meet evolutionary muster? I mean, I don't quite understand why biodiversity becomes the key and central theme. But nonetheless, let's return to our theme, which is stewardship. We're going to give an answer to God for our stewardship of creation. That's where an evangelical environmentalism has to begin. Our environmental approach has to begin with the fact that we'll be judged and we'll have to give an answer for what we did with this gift that God has given us. We'll be right back. Interesting conversation about environmentalism. Where is the common ground between the secular scientific community and the evangelical community on environmentalism? And is there even a possibility here? The conversation is itself very significant. To join us, call 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. I've had requests from international listeners for how to call into the program. To call in and join us right now, call 011-1502-897-4186. Again, that's the international calling code for the U.S., 011 plus 1 plus 502-897-4186 for international listeners. Let's go to Craig, calling from West Point, Kentucky, listening on WFIA. Go ahead, Craig.
Thank you, Dr. Mohler. The question I have is, environmentalists are trying to save the planet, whereas Christians are merely stewards of the planet. We know what the end game is going to be. So how can we have a conversation with people that are merely trying to use us?
Well, you know, let me offer a potential here. I think even though our purpose of evangelism is higher than any environmentalism, we do answer to our Creator for all things. So, Craig, what about this? What if, for instance, we're talking about a toxic dump? We're talking about Lake Erie back in the 1960s. We would have common ground there, right, to be concerned that that is a sin. That would be our side of the equation. We believe it's sin to despoil creation in that way. I guess the secular environmentalists have to say it's just a negative impact on the environment. But we would have common ground there to say it ought to be cleaned up, right?
Right, absolutely. We would, but you know, until environmentalists actually understand and believe that there is a Creator God, I think the whole conversation's mute, really.
Well, it's certainly not a conversation in which the worldview is shared. That's absolutely true. The question is, even when we don't share a basic worldview, which I wish we did, my greatest concern for E.O. Wilson is not his environmentalism, but what I believe to be his need for a relationship with Jesus Christ. But at the same time, there is a conversation here that can be had. And that's interesting, just to think about the fact that even with incompatible worldviews, there are certain things on which we can agree. I think once you start getting to the specifics, and this is what I said in my review of Professor Wilson's book, once you get into the specifics, I think we're going to find that the differences in the worldview lead to differences in policies as well. But we're not there yet. Thanks for the call, Craig. Let's go to Jennifer calling from Bristol, Virginia, listening on WHCB. Go ahead, Jennifer.
Well, in general, I think this is a positive thing. I think that this the atheist agnostic community has seen us as this cloistered community who only has our mind on heavenly things. And not that that's not important. I think that's the most important thing, but that we have no common ground, that we don't have an interest in nature as it supports the human condition. And I think if we could come to some place where we could look at this problem rationally on both sides, I mean, we have a tendency to look at environmentalists that all of them are ones that would put nature above humanity. I don't think they're all like that. I think if we could come to some common ground and use common sense and reason in looking at these problems, then I think it would open some dialogue for addressing their worldview and maybe opening some fallacies in it.
Jennifer, what a thoughtful suggestion. I agree with you. We just lost her there, but I agree with you. Let me say that I think you hit the key issue, and it's going to be the sticky wicket here. And you talked about the distinction between human beings and other species. And you mentioned the fact these other species are necessary for human life. That's true. You see, the secular environmentalist can't really suggest that human beings are all that different than any other species. And that's where you take the question of biodiversity, and you can lead to some very divergent paths between the Christian and the secular environmentalist. For instance, do I believe that biodiversity is a good thing? Yes, it's right in the Garden of Eden. Do I believe that, for instance, the life of one of those animals is on the same level as the life of any single human being? No, I don't. And so that's where I think we'd have some different policies. But, Jennifer, you're right. A conversation about this, let me make what may seem to be an extreme argument here. A conversation about this, even a conversation about environmentalism, is, from a kingdom perspective, an evangelistic conversation. Why? Because as we talk to a secular environmentalist about our understanding of our stewardship of the earth and all the rest, we're actually talking to them about why we are Christians. We're actually talking to them about what Christianity really demands of us. We're really talking about what Christianity promises us. And so in a conversation like this, even in talking about the environment, it's never only talking about the environment. It's not from their side. Their worldview leaks all over the place into this conversation, and so does ours. Thanks for the call, Jennifer. Let's go to Derek calling from Bloomington, Illinois. Go ahead, Derek.
Hi. My question's kind of changed a little bit, but I was just going to say, do we want to associate ourselves with people that are could be atheists? Do we really want to? I know that we can find common ground, and it's a good point to evangelize, but being associated with atheists and working together on the same thing, I think we need to be really honest with ourselves and say that they're doing it for a whole nother reason, and
yep.
In a sense, they might be sinning.
Well, that's true. That's true, Derek. And, you know, always a cogent and proper warning to take care here. You know, the confession of faith of my church, of our denomination, I think expresses this really well. It says that Christians can work with fellow Christians of like faith in evangelism. And so what does that mean? That means that I can work with people who I believe really understand the gospel in evangelism. I wouldn't work with people who I believe have a deficient understanding of the gospel. But our confession of faith also says, but we can work with persons of goodwill on any number of issues, such as, you know, if disaster relief or something like that. In responding to the tidal wave in Thailand, you had Christian missionaries working right alongside people who may have been complete pagans, you know, and in many cases certainly were worshiping false gods. You had atheists and all the rest. And yet it was right for Christians to be there on that disaster scene working on that project. And yet it wouldn't be right for them, Derek, to join and hold a worship service together. And it wouldn't be right for them, I would even argue, to establish a school and teach together where you're going to be dealing with spiritual realities. That wouldn't work. I certainly wouldn't hire an atheist. I wouldn't hire a theological liberal. I wouldn't hire any number of persons to teach on the faculty of this school. But in a time of emergency, I'd grab the fire hose with them. Does that make any sense, Derek?
Yeah, it does.
Thanks for your calls. Good to hear from Bloomington, Illinois as well. Folks, this is the kind of conversation that Christians need to have in order to think in advance. And Derek's question really helps to focus this. We need to think in advance, where exactly are we willing to go with this conversation? And where must we not go if we're going to be faithful to Christ and faithful to the gospel? I'll be back with some final thoughts in just a moment. Coast to coast and with listeners all over the world, this is the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. Our conversation today with E.O. Wilson is one of those that I think will be bookmarking for future conversations as well. I've read his stuff for a long time, and I would have to place him as one of the central scientific thinkers in America whose thought is so very much opposed to Christianity. In his writings, in his public appearances, articles he's written for the Harvard Magazine, his scientific papers and all the rest, he's been very clear that he thinks that scientific naturalism or scientific humanism, as he calls it, is the only worldview that makes sense. And it's very clear he does not share our convictions. He doesn't want to call himself an atheist or an agnostic. He calls himself a provisional deist. And just so that we clarify that, he suggests that he is in no position to say that there is no God, only there is no God in which he believes that has any important role to play in the question. That's so different from where we start every one of our thoughts. That's just diametrically opposed to our originating point for thinking, which is the existence of the self-revealing God. Now, that makes all the difference in the world, because when we want to know what is most important, what is fundamentally true, and what is of eternal significance, we have to turn to the Word of God, this God who is self-existent and self-revealing, has spoken to us in his Word. By the way, he is the Creator. He's revealed that. And we are the creature. He's told us that. And we'll give an answer to our Creator for all things. He's emphatic about that. But you start from a very different position with what he calls scientific humanism. And there you start with the brute fact of the world, the universe. Now, how do we interpret that? Well, Professor Wilson says you look at all the biodiversity and you respond with a sense of wonder. And you also respond with a sense of urgency in terms of what he thinks is our responsibility to protect biodiversity in order to protect human life. Two very different starting points. And as I say, this will lead to two very different sets of policy proposals as well. But just maybe E.O. Wilson's book is a wake-up call for some evangelicals to remember we do have a stewardship responsibility. We will give God an answer. We'll answer to the Creator for our care of his good earth. Now, at the same time, we know that that is not our utmost priority. And we know that this earth is not that which is to be worshipped, whether its Creator. We also understand this earth is passing away. What looks so permanent is actually temporary. We look forward to that day when there is a new heaven and a new earth, but that day will also come with our answer for our care of this world. A conversation about important and urgent things, things that matter, is a rare gift these days. Professor Wilson has at least offered us that invitation. He came on the program today, and for that we owe him our respect and gratitude. We also owe the Creator far deeper thoughts about how we're going to give an answer for our stewardship of his earth. We'll be back to talk about a Christian environmentalism again. I'll see you tomorrow.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.